Well, good morning. Nice to see you all. It's been a real pleasure to be with you the last 3 weeks, and very much looking forward to finishing up the study. By the way, I have written an article on this topic that goes into all that we've talked about the last 2 weeks and this morning as well, goes into it in more depth and detail. So that should be up and available on our Areopagus website within a couple of days, and also on our Facebook page. So if you'd like to check that out, and maybe there are portions of it that you might want to refer to this coming Thursday. Now, speaking of this coming Thursday, this will mark actually the 400th anniversary of the original Thanksgiving feast. So it certainly is momentous in that respect. And so hopefully you can integrate some of the history we've been talking about the last couple of weeks into your celebration on Thursday as well. One other announcement is that periodically, or at least prior to the COVID era in American history, we would do an Areopagus Christian Heritage tour, Christian History Tour. And next year in September, we will be doing a tour of the life and locations associated with the life of C.S. Lewis. So that'll be in September of 2022. We'll be, of course, in Cambridge and Oxford and London and Belfast, and I'm told on the agenda is also a visit to the Titanic Museum. I remember telling Peter Grayling that C.S. Lewis, who died in 1963, I was not aware that he went down with the Titanic. But apparently it's a fascinating place to visit nonetheless. So I hope you had an opportunity to download the outline for this morning. It's quite a lot of material. We do have some slides, though, that distill most of the major points I'll be making as we go along. Now, last week, just by way of brief review, we talked about who these pilgrims were. They were separatist Christians or nonconformist Christians. We talked about their distinctive beliefs, their leaders, people like John Robinson, and later as they come over to America, William Bradford, who's the governor of Plymouth Colony for most of the first 40 years of its history. We talked about the persecution of the separatists back in England. Why were they persecuted? We talked about their refuge in Holland for several years and why they eventually left Holland and risked coming to North America. Then we focused on their settlement here in America, their arduous journey across the Atlantic Ocean on the Mayflower. Talked about the Mayflower Compact and their struggle for survival once they arrived in America with the help of local friendly natives, in particular Squanto, whom William Bradford, you might recall, referred to as a special instrument sent from God for our good. Then we went on and referenced the first Thanksgiving, the subsequent threats that the colony had to endure, and some distinctive issues related to Plymouth Christianity. In particular, even though these people come to America for religious freedom, they are, like most Christians back in those days, they are sacralists. They believe in this alliance or union of church and state. And so as their Puritan neighbors would later put it in one of their laws, we believe in religious freedom. Everyone has the freedom not to associate with us if they don't hold to our beliefs. So that's Christian sacralism, and that was typical of most Christians back in these days. Now, we ended last week talking about the socioeconomic system there in Plymouth for the first several years and how they transition from socialism to private property. And we talked about how that under socialism, the community, even though it was generally a Christian community, it was terribly underproductive. But then once they transitioned to private property rights, individual incentives sets in, and it becomes a far more productive community from that point on, which just emphasizes a point that we need to constantly keep in mind, and that is the importance of individual responsibility, okay, rather than depending upon the state and others to take care of our needs. So this morning, let's take a look here at, sort of by way of a postscript, the Pilgrims and the Origins of America's Culture War. And this is basically a prologue to getting back and finishing up our treatment of the Pilgrims themselves. But let's start with this realization. There have never been freer Christians in all of history than American Christians in general. In general, American Christians have not only been the freest Christians in all of history, but the most privileged Christians and in many respects, the most prosperous Christians. But over the last decades, we've witnessed an absolutely withering assault on Christian beliefs and values in our nation by a very powerful, a very insidious coalition of secular forces that have infiltrated and infested and taken control of most of our cultural institutions. Now, not only are basic Christian moral principles under constant attack today, but religious liberty itself is being threatened by this hostile anti-Christian agenda that's being promoted by our cultural elites. Now, whether we call this cultural Marxism or political correctness or critical theory or their religious ally, so-called progressive Christianity, it's systematically destroying the moral and the spiritual foundations of this nation. Now, many people today, including many Christians and church leaders, want to deny that there is a culture war going on. They're totally out of touch with reality. And even those who do understand the dangers that we're facing today, many suppose that the culture war probably started back in the 1960s with the emergence of the sexual revolution, the new left, and the counterculture. Or as my father used to say for decades after the 60s, blame it on the Beatles. Now, others who have a little more extended view of history might take it back to the explosion of hedonism right after World War I that characterized the Roaring Twenties. But in fact, the origin of America's culture war really extends back virtually to the very beginning, within just a few years after the founding of Plymouth Colony. Now, you might recall that from the outset, America was founded by colonists who were motivated by a variety of factors. Some came for religious liberty, and they had quite an influence in general. Others came more for political freedom. These would be political dissidents who believed in local self-government so as to avoid the tyranny of monarchs and local officials back in England. For many, the primary motive in coming to America was personal ambition. They were looking for greater social and economic opportunity. But for a few, their prime motive in coming here was what we might call libertine hedonism. In other words, they wanted to live outside the boundaries of normal social mores. And they believed that America, being basically uncivilized at the time, would provide that opportunity. Now, when the first histories of America were written in the early 19th century, historians tended to emphasize these first three factors, the political, the religious, and the personal agendas. But in fact, as we transition into the 20th century, a lot of historians, influenced by secular historicism and a Marxist analysis of history, tended to focus almost exclusively on the socioeconomic factors, which again were significant. But virtually no historians until pretty recent times gave the fourth factor, libertine hedonism, very much consideration. But this impulse was present from the very beginning, at least for some colonists, and we'll talk about them this morning. Now, in Plymouth Colony, no longer had no sooner had the separatists endured the bleak conditions of those first few years in North America than they encounter a wholly new challenge, a challenge for which they were not prepared for. A group of English immigrants led by Thomas Morton settled a few miles up the coast of Massachusetts at Mount Wollaston, which was later renamed Marymount. Now, unlike the devout and very sober separatists, the Marymounters had a different agenda. In philosophical terms, this became a battle between basically two contrasting worldviews. The Puritan vision of a Christian commonwealth, or as they and the Puritans who followed after them put it, a city on a hill, a righteous city on a hill, as opposed to the vision of America as a secular utopia. A secular utopia basically established by libertarian humanists with few laws and rules and regulations regarding their individual beliefs and their personal behavior. Now, while one vision conceived of the New World as an opportunity to build a new Jerusalem, the other sought to set up a new Babylon in North America, or eventually, I guess, Las Vegas. Now, in retrospect, this confrontation that ensued between these two communities of settlers was in effect the first skirmish in America's ongoing culture war. In 1624, Thomas Morton led a party of about 30 young men from England to settle in Massachusetts. Now, Morton was a pretty well-known figure in England at the time. He was a lawyer, a writer, a social reformer, and a very free spirit who personalized and personified the values and morals of pre-Puritan Merry Old England. Although born into a high Anglican family, Morton was drawn to the morally lax libertine culture of the Elizabethan period in England while studying law in London. Now, through his social connections, he became involved with a man named Fernando Gorgas, who was the governor of Plymouth, England, the town of Plymouth, England. He became involved with Gorgas, who was a sponsor of overseas colonization. And in 1622, Morton accompanied an exploration expedition off the coast of New England. And in the process of doing that, he visited the Plymouth colony that had just recently been planted. And although he was absolutely intrigued by the prospects of colonization, he dismisses the separatists as being insufferable, self-righteous prigs. Now, returning back home, he helps organize a colonial trading enterprise sponsored by Fernando Gorgas and other investors with a vision for planting a colony based on liberal, humanitarian, humanistic values. And over the next year, he recruits about 30 young men to join him, most of whom followed him along as indentured servants. Essentially, their passage to America was paid for by others, but they will serve as voluntary slaves for a set period of time, and then they'll be set free, indentured servants. Now, Morton and his party founded Mount Wollaston. This was about 20 miles north of Plymouth. Immediately, they began farming, trading for furs and other provisions on land given to them by the local native tribe, the Algonquins. Morton admired the natives' culture, their primitive animism essentially nature worship, essentially. That's animism, essentially. So he admired their culture, their primitive animism, and their uninhibited social customs, particularly their more lax sexual mores. And in fact, he considered the, quote, savages, as they were typically called back then, to be, in fact, more civilized and more humanitarian than his fellow Englishmen who lived down the coast at Plymouth. Now, although he was only at best a nominal Christian, Morton reportedly sought to convert the Algonquins to his liberal brand of Christianity, Anglican Christianity. Now, remember, back in these days, virtually all Englishmen, like virtually all Europeans, identified themselves as, quote, Christians, unless they were ethnically Jewish or Muslim. Okay. So to call oneself a Christian back in these days, frankly, did not mean much. It needed very careful defining. Now, from the outset, there's tensions between these new settlers at Mount Wollaston and the colonists in Plymouth. The separatists considered Morton to be a virtual heathen. They also accused him of being an impious drunkard, a hedonistic antinomian. An antinomian is somebody who believes that they live above and outside the common rules and laws of society. Okay. So according to the separatists, Morton is an antinomian. He lives by, in his mind, a higher standard of behavior and thinking and so on. And they also regarded him as an irresponsible troublemaker who promoted immoral sexual relations between his young men and some of the local Algonquin girls. But even more alarming to the pilgrims was were the rumors, at least, that Morton and his colony were trading guns to the local natives. And, of course, the separatists at this time, they'd only been settled for 3 or 4 years, and they are still very concerned about potential hostility on the part of local natives. Now, on the other hand, Morton was openly scornful of the separatists for their exclusive religious beliefs and their legalistic moral codes. He ridicules and mocks their leaders, such as the very diminutive, very short military commander Miles Standish, whom he derisively referred to as Captain Shrimp. Relations then between the two communities grew all the more tense over the next couple of years as some of the young men began defecting from Plymouth to Mount Wollaston, drawn by the lax laws and the libertine spirit that Thomas Morton and his colony provided. Now, since the success and even the survival of both colonies depended upon a growing population, the fact that some of their young men were leaving Plymouth was very troublesome to the separatists, even though they dismissed a lot of these young men who left and migrated to Mount Wollaston. They dismissed them as basically, quote, scum. Now, in 1628, Morton further antagonized the Plymouth leaders by renaming his settlement Marymount. Furthermore, he announced a special May Day celebration in which he organized a pagan Greek-style festival to reward his hardworking comrades. He's a very shrewd promoter, and he orders the erection of an 80-foot-tall maypole and invites local natives to celebrate with them, including plenty of young females. Now, back in Plymouth, Governor William Bradford condemns this maypole as a pagan symbol, basically a pagan idol, and he compares the Marymount festivities to a Roman bacchanalia. He later noted in his memoirs, quote, "They set up a maypole, drinking and dancing about it for many days, inviting Indian women as their consorts, dancing and frisking together, and worse practices." In Plymouth, there were anti-frisking laws. Now, seeing their New Jerusalem threatened by this influx of what they considered to be Babylonians or Canaanites, the separatists take preemptive action. Captain Standish and a special ops force march through the night. They catch the unsuspecting Marymounters by surprise, and they chop down that maypole. They also manage to capture Thomas Morton, and they bind him in chains, bring him back to Plymouth on charges of supplying guns to the Indians. Now, Morton, by the way, later claimed that he and his party had surrendered peacefully to avoid bloodshed, but Bradford contended that the Marymounters were simply too drunk to fight. Okay. Now, back in Plymouth, Bradford was reluctant to execute Morton because of Morton's political connections in London. So they put him in stocks, gave him a mock trial, and marooned him on a deserted island until a ship could take him back home. And according to Morton, he would have starved to death had not some local natives smuggled in some food for him. Now, the very next year, in 1629, thousands of Puritans begin arriving in Massachusetts. And like the separatists in Plymouth, they were resolutely hostile to these Marymount colonists. They referred to Marymount as, quote, Mount Dagon, In other words, a reference to the evil Canaanite god that we read about in the Bible. And in the winter of 1629, the Puritans raided the colony's food supplies. By the following spring, most of the colony's inhabitants had scattered, and its buildings were destroyed a year or so after that. So the end of Wollaston or Marymount. But the story continues with Morton's revenge. Morton returns to Massachusetts in 1629, but he was promptly arrested, tried, and banished from the colony once again. So back in England, Morton wages a propaganda war against the Puritans and the Pilgrims, and particularly Massachusetts Bay Company, which had sponsored the Puritan colonial venture. And in the end, the court of public opinion in England began to support Thomas Morton, who portrays himself as a victim of Pilgrim and Puritan intolerance. And he also claimed that his civil liberties, of course, had been unjustly violated. So skillfully exploiting his connections in the court of King Charles I, he manages to have Parliament revoke the charter of the Massachusetts Bay Colony in 1635. And then a couple of years after that, in 1637, Thomas Morton publishes a book called The New English Canaan, in which, among other things, he described his persecution by the Puritans and the Pilgrims, and also describes the erection of the Maypole at Marymount and the culture war that ignited. And he put it this way, quote, "The inhabitants of Marymount did devise among themselves to have revels and merriment after the old English custom, and therefore they brewed barrels of excellent beer and provided a case of bottles to be spent with other good cheer for all the comers of that day. And upon May Day they brought the Maypole to the place appointed with drums and guns and pistols and other fitting instruments for that purpose, and they erected it with the help of the local savages that came hither of purpose to see the manner of our revels. A goodly pine tree of 80 foot long was reared up, and a pair of buckshorns, or antlers, were nailed to it." Now, so that's his account. And several years later, the English Civil War, of course, is going to break out in 1642. And Morton, of course, was a staunch supporter of the king. And so he winds up on the losing side of that conflict in England. And once again, and virtually inexplicably, he crosses the Atlantic and seeks refuge in New England. He's not exactly welcomed with open arms, however. When he disembarks, he's promptly arrested as a royalist agitator. He's charged with sedition and conspiracy regarding the revocation of the colony's charter, and he's thrown into a dank dungeon for the winter. And after suffering several months in prison, his health broke, and he was granted clemency, but he's cut off from his supporters in England. He has no friends here in New England, and he withers away and dies a couple of years later in Maine. Now, what's the legacy of this? Well, the history of Mount Wollaston actually did not end with the burning of its buildings and the scattering of its inhabitants in the late 1620s. In fact, over the next 150 years, the area around the former community continued to be associated with free thinkers and rebels. For instance, in 1636, the radical Anne Hutchinson briefly settled there with her family after they were expelled from the Puritan Commonwealth in Boston for holding again to antinomian views and heretical views. In the mid-1600s, the Mount Wollaston area was renamed Braintree, and later the name was switched to Quincy, Massachusetts, and in the early 1700s, the grandfather of John Adams bought the old Mount Wollaston farm. So John Adams actually inherited the farm, lived there most of his life. Also, in the mid-1700s, another very notable American revolutionary, John Hancock, was also born and raised in Quincy, Massachusetts. Now, in 1837, long afterward, the novelist Nathaniel Hawthorne wrote an imaginative story about the culture clash between the Puritans in Plymouth and the libertines of Marymount. He called it The Maypole of Marymount. Perhaps you read it in high school. in your American literature class or something. And in keeping with the times, Nathaniel Hawthorne, of course, depicts Morton and his followers as merry revelers, just minding their own business, more or less, and innocent victims of Puritan intolerance and self-righteousness. Then, to kind of update it to the present, in 1934, the WPA erected a long wall around the Mount Wollaston Cemetery dedicated to the memory of Thomas Morton. And in recent years, Wiccans and other neo-pagans have periodically descended on the area to celebrate the story of Marymount in honor of Americans' pagan heritage. Now let's transition to the Summa, the summary of it all. And I'd like to talk about the evolution of America's culture war. And I'll start with a song title from Bob Dylan in 1963, The Times They Are A-Changin'. And by the way, 30 years after writing The Times They Are A-Changin' in 1963, in other words, in 1992, Bob Dylan wrote another song that appeared on another of his albums called Everything Is Broken. What song title would be most appropriate today, do you suppose? The times they are changing, everything is broken. So what do we call our current time? It's shattered. It's being shattered, isn't it? And so to paraphrase the times they are changing, gradually over time, the fundamental issues in America's ongoing culture war have certainly changed as well. By the time of the American Revolution, by the way, there no longer was much of a conflict between different groups of Christian sacralists. In other words, groups that wanted to set up their church as the official state church and essentially tax everyone else for the support of their state church. That's Christian sacralism, essentially. And by the time of the American Revolution, that no longer was really much of an issue anymore. As America became increasingly diverse religiously, the dominance of these state churches, Congregationalism in New England, Anglicanism in most of the American colonies, they had gradually, over time, lost their control. And more and more Christians, by the time of the American Revolution, we're coming to the realization that true Christianity is voluntary. True Christianity cannot be mandated to society at large. In other words, this idea of compulsive Christianity and coercive Christianity is absolutely, as you know, antithetical to the very spirit of the gospel itself. So by the time of the American Revolution, most Americans had come to the realization that not only religious tolerance, but outright religious freedom was preferable to state-sponsored and state-controlled religion. This became the assumption behind the emerging consensus of separatism, or separation of church and state. And as we've said before, that term, separation of church and state, has been used very disingenuously really for a century or more now, by secularists, militant secularists, who are trying to expel any reference or any influence of the Christian faith from public life. But as you know, and we've talked about this before, that was not the original intention of separation of church and state. It was merely the separation of the two institutions of government and religion. Now, the new divisions in the culture war today have become more philosophical than theological. And on one side, what we have are those who, many of whom are Bible-believing Christians, by the way, who conscientiously try to uphold the basic moral principles of what traditionally is referred to as natural law. These are moral and ethical values that are essential for the well-being and for the maintenance of any society. As such, these principles constitute the basic moral foundation for social and political civility. These principles also constitute basic moral and ethical standards to which all people can and should be held accountable, whether they're Christians or not. And by the way, this is the concept that the Apostle Paul writes about in Romans 1 and 2. There are certain moral, ethical principles that are innate to humanity, and we violate them only through willful rebellion. Okay? Now, these principles are also in keeping with the rule of law as encapsulated in the U.S. Constitution. Principles such as everyone is created equal and endowed by their creator and endowed with certain unalienable rights, the right to life, right to liberty, and the right to pursuit of happiness. And also the principle of equal justice under the law in an equal opportunity society. Although these natural law principles are compatible with basic Christian morality, Christians are called, of course, to a much higher standard of moral and ethical living. We're called to live out our association with others individually and collectively under the principle of agape love. Okay? But again, that's not a standard that we can possibly impose on society in general. For society in general, there are these basic natural moral laws to which everyone should be held accountable. For Christians, we're called above and beyond just basic natural law standards. But as I say, specifically, Christian values and standards cannot and should not be forced on society at large. So that's one position, the natural law position. On the other side today, we have those who have gradually drifted toward a more secular and humanistic orientation. This orientation holds that everything is relative. There are no absolute morals. We just make up morality as we supposedly progress socially. Furthermore, all religions and moral codes are merely man-made, which means that they are all more or less equal. And that the purpose of life is not to love God with all our heart, soul, mind, and strength and love others as we love ourselves, but rather the purpose of life is individual self-fulfillment. And in keeping with the theory of human social and biological evolution, laws should evolve to reflect changing attitudes and changing times. And this has been our challenge, basically, over the last 200 years. These two incompatible worldviews. They're irreconcilable and incompatible, frankly. We can and should insist that our laws uphold the basic principles of natural law that are applicable to every person in any well-ordered society. This is the nexus, though, of America's contemporary culture war. And this is what's being systematically undermined and destroyed in our nation today. Now, many Christians are very uncomfortable with the very idea of a culture war. By temperament, I can relate to that, by temperament. But as Christians, we sincerely desire to live in peace with all people as much as possible, just as we aspire to be as tolerant and accepting of others as possible. But idealism does not alter reality. And the truth is, the culture war exists whether we prefer to acknowledge it or not. As the author and talk show host Dennis Prager observes, Americans are more divided morally, ideologically, and politically today than they were during the American Civil War. In fact, the failure of so many Christians to get informed and engaged in the great issues of our time has contributed to the secularization and the corruption of modern American society and culture. In effect, we are losing the culture war because we have essentially forfeited it to our opponents. And as a result, we see the consequences in a culture that's rapidly decaying and disintegrating all around us. Now, American Christianity faces a lot of challenges. But the greatest threats come from within our own society under the rubric of cultural liberalism. This ideology, whether we want to identify it as secular humanism or cultural Marxism or political correctness or critical theory or whatever, poses the greatest threat today to individual morality, civic virtue, social sanity. It poses a great danger to our cultural institutions and virtually every aspect of American culture, including the church itself. America's culture war is not an illusion, and those who refuse to acknowledge it are either spiritually and morally blind, they are perhaps egregiously apathetic, or they're just too timid to acknowledge it and engage it. Furthermore, by the way, the issues at stake are anything but trivial. Although many of these issues are superficially, quote, political, in the sense that virtually everything in life has political ramifications. By the way, probably the most radical political declaration anyone could possibly make is the declaration that the early Christians made, and that is Jesus is Lord, not Caesar, not the state, not the government. Jesus is Lord. So many of these issues are superficially political, but in fact, they are essentially moral issues that we're talking about. And at the deepest level, as you know, these are spiritual issues. These issues are substantive and serious, and they reveal fundamental differences regarding our understanding of truth and morality and justice, as well as our view of what kind of a society and culture America should be. Furthermore, on issues like this, there's relatively little room for compromise. 2 Corinthians 6:14 tells us, what do righteousness and wickedness have in common? Or what fellowship can light have with darkness? Likewise, what common ground is there between the pro-life and the pro-abortion agendas? Tell me what the middle ground is there. What common ground is there between a free society and a fascist authoritarian society? See, turbulent times call for people of courage and conviction, people who understand the issues that are at stake, and people that are willing to fight for what's right and true. As Christians, we understand that underlying this culture war is a spiritual struggle. We see this culture war being played out in our churches and in all of our major Christian denominations. Gross heresies, everything from theological liberalism or so-called progressive Christianity to the word of faith prosperity gospel heresy. They've all perverted the true faith that was once and for all entrusted to us by the prophets, the apostles, and the people of faith who preceded us, as we read about in the book of Jude. Furthermore, we know that the primary battleground in this war is not the ballot box. It's the human heart. And that what we see manifest in our society and culture today is merely the surface level expression of a titanic struggle going on between good and evil that's being waged in the spiritual realm. So let's not be so foolish as just to dismiss all of this as merely political. Now, the differences that divide us are not superficial. They're not just stylistic or primarily tactical. In substance, the division is between those who believe in absolute transcendent truth and universal moral laws, based ultimately on the principles of Scripture, of course, versus those who believe that everything is relative, everything subjective, and everything should change in keeping with the times and the trends of our time. Now, as the Christian philosopher and apologist Francis Schaeffer concluded in his last major work called A Christian Manifesto, this was written, in the early 1980s, but it's still every bit as relevant today as it was when Schaeffer wrote it all those years ago. As Schaeffer put it, there is no way to mix these two total worldviews. They are separate entities, and they cannot be synthesized. Similarly, in the words of Dennis Prager, America will be united only when one of these worldviews prevails over the other. Now, many cultural liberals seem to understand this. But many cultural conservatives, including many Christians, and by the way, church leaders, apparently do not understand this. When a war is being waged, either a literal war involving killing and destruction and conquest, or a figurative culture war, or a form of spiritual warfare for that matter, and only one side is dedicated to fighting, there's no question who will win. Of course, Scripture assures us that in the end, God will prevail. All evil will be vanquished. Thank God. And we should continue to pray each and every day, Maranatha, come Lord Jesus, come quickly Lord Jesus. But there's no assurance that the second coming, that the eschaton will happen in our lifetime or even in the next generation or even in the next century. So we have a great responsibility. In the meantime, we need to fight to preserve anything that's left in our society of honor, civility, decency, and freedom, including our religious freedom, which is very much threatened today. If we truly love others as Jesus commanded us to do, including our children, our grandchildren, and others who are following after us, we need to fight with great faith and courage for what's right. And to do otherwise is absolutely faithless, it's cowardly, and it's irresponsible. So in closing, let me just cite the Apostle Paul's message at the Areopagus in Athens that we read in Acts chapter 17, in which Paul stated, quote, "The God who made the world made every nation of men that they should inhabit the whole earth, and he determined the time set for them and the exact places where they should live." That's just a phenomenal concept to consider. In other words, we are right here right now for a particular reason, and I'm pretty sure it's not merely to maximize our pleasure in life, to have as much fun as possible. So we were born for such a time as this, and we need to take this with utmost seriousness. That's why we are right here, right now, according to God's providential will. Well, do we have a few minutes for a few responses, questions, and so on? Okay, thank you. Like I said, I have written an article on all of this, and we'll have it posted on our Areopagus website in just a few days if you're interested in checking it out. So any questions, anything that could use clarification or otherwise comments?
I've had people say things like, isn't it selfish for you to demand religious freedom or to... Yeah. Have you heard that kind of a comment?
Like, I can imagine it.
It's yes. All about, it shouldn't be all about us. We're Christians. We should be turning the other cheek. We should be loving and kind toward others. Right. And it's just selfish if you're wanting what I call religious liberty.
Well, and again, the religious liberty applies to all. And you should have the freedom to be an atheist, to be a Muslim, and, you know, any other belief. As I said, coercive or compulsory Christianity is just absolutely antithetical to everything the gospel stands for. So we do believe in freedom and liberty when it comes to people expressing their beliefs and their faith. Yeah. Pat, yeah, here.
You mentioned the solution early, just a few minutes ago, in terms of agape love. And the word confront and fight are difficult to synthesize with agape love, and yet that is the solution. Mm-hmm. In other words, I think God is calling us to engage, befriend, and invite and love. And that is the way that we are supposed to fight. In other words, those who are different from us and don't think like us and so forth.
Yes.
Giving them the opposite answer and confronting them with placards and statements and so forth is not the same as engaging them and listening to their story and loving right. them. And I think that's what we need to understand, that it's mm-hmm. our agape love, mm-hmm. the way we're supposed to fight, but we are Absolutely. Supposed to fight.
Yes, our only perfect example is Jesus himself. We are enjoined to speak the truth in love. So how you do it matters a lot. But nonetheless, we must speak the truth. But we need to do it because of love for others. Yes. Yeah. Bob, are you next?
Are we to be encouraged, perhaps, in the one area that I think we are making progress from a cultural win, is the right to life? It looks like, politically, that wall is being slowly broken down. And if we can ever get Roe versus Wade eliminated from our society, that particular inroad may encourage all of us to be more rigorous in our political attitude. I understand Pat's obvious attitude there about agape love, but sometimes it takes a little bit more argumentative and political approach to sort of change things.
Well, I don't know of a more controversial person in history than Jesus. So he doesn't back down, but it's all done in the spirit of love. And there are positions and people that, frankly, do need correcting. But again, how we do it is of utmost importance. You're quite correct about that. So we need to fight using the weapons of the Spirit, and we need to share the truth in a spirit of love and concern, because that's really what it's all about. We do want a more just and civil and decent society for everyone, not just Christians. Yeah. Bob? Yes.
Yeah, Jeffrey, we're told to be salt and light on earth. We're right. members of two societies, two kingdoms, heavenly and earthly. Mm-hmm. And our main emphasis, morally and spiritually, is to be concentrated in our spiritual warfare, as you're saying.
That's right.
And the church has been a conscience in society. And I believe in history.
At times. That's right.
And Christians are loud in church and silent in the world today. Mm. We're not speaking the gospel where is the power of God to mm-hmm. change hearts, mm-hmm. to change society.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, this is our main way of overcoming this, is to speak the gospel, to live up to it, and show Christ as the King.
Absolutely. And in so many respects, the church is failing to do that.
Absolutely.
You can go back to 1964, Martin Luther King speaking, and he said, you know, the church is supposed to be a cult, is supposed to function as a cultural thermostat. Instead, the church too often is merely a cultural thermometer. Big difference in a thermometer and a thermostat. And so I think he was absolutely correct about that. Yes. Yeah, thank you. Other comments?
Yes, we, on an individual basis, of course, we're supposed to be salt and light and in our culture. But even Paul used the fact that he was a Roman citizen. He mm-hmm. he used the laws that were there at the time. So
yeah.
we do have to become educated, and we do have to take a stand. I just heard about a story of a woman, a mom, who's the FBI just battered down her door, you know, and she put her in handcuffs for nothing. She was, you know, one of the moms that went mm-hmm. to some of these school board meetings and so forth. And, you know, this is very important. We still need to be informed about these things and hold on to the rights that we do have in our laws.
Well, thank God, as I said at the outset, we Christians in America in general have been the most free, the most prosperous, the most privileged Christians in all of history. And we do have certain citizenship rights. And those have been granted to us by God, but through some founding fathers who were wise in this respect. And we need to continue to uphold those rights that we have, lest we become like most of the rest of the world. Yeah, thank you. Yeah. Any I believe a comment or question back here.
I really appreciate your versatility in covering all the grounds that are really the foundation of our survival. And I'm thinking of my walk and how it makes more difference than what I say. And I was looking at asking you to, if we could get a printout of what your last comments were the last 15 minutes, because it'd be great for me to, or all of us, to be able to post it in any way that we can. And I'd also ask you if there's any institutions or gatherings that we could coincide with to group together. I mean, together is more powerful, and three, and you know, in multiples. Uh-huh. But I want to appreciate what you laid it as sound and true as I have ever heard it, and I appreciate it, and I would like to push it and expose your rapport.
Well, thank you. And there are a lot of dedicated Christians who have organizations that are very, very worthy of our support financially, but also our active involvement in as well. And if you want to send me an email, I could send you a few recommendations. Also, a lot of what I talked about over the last 3 weeks is incorporated in my book, American Crisis, about the culture war in America. And also some of it actually is taken from C.S. Lewis on politics, government, and the good society. So I'm not here to sell books, but you might want to check those out. They're all on Amazon, of course. Now, a lot of what I've taught the last 3 weeks related to the Pilgrims and Plymouth Colony and the eruption of the culture war comes out of the first chapter, actually, of American Crisis. Yeah. So thank you. Do we have time for one more? One more? Okay, Garland, you have the last word. This okay. is this is a great responsibility.
Okay, I wondered. excuse me. I would wonder if you could contrast the Mayflower Compact with the Jamestown Charters, because the Mayflower Compact, the settlers came for the advancement of the Christian faith and the glory of God, and it's very similar to Jamestown charters, but yet there's all the emphasis on the Pilgrims and none on Jamestown. So I was wondering if you could just elaborate a little bit about that.
Oh, well, that's a wonderful question. The difference in the first colony that survived, and that is Jamestown in Virginia, and Plymouth Colony. Jamestown was founded primarily for economic purposes and for nationalistic mercantile purposes on the part of the monarchs in England. Now, that's not to say there were not true Christians there at James. They were all at least professing Anglicans. But it was really not founded on the same direct spiritual bases that Plymouth was. So there was basically a difference between those two colonies. My earliest ancestor came to America from France in 1633, and he settled in Jamestown. And Jamestown by then was about 25 years old. And it was explicitly an Anglican community. Now, he was not an Anglican. He was a French Huguenot, a French Calvinist Protestant. And because he was not an Anglican, he was not well accepted there at Jamestown. Again, another point to be made about Christianity should never be compulsory. I'm sorry, it should be compulsive, but not compulsory or mandated. So he actually had to leave Jamestown after just a few years. And where did he go? Well, he went to a colony that was founded by Catholics. But interestingly, for various reasons, that colony was the first to grant religious toleration to all colonists in America, and that was Maryland. Okay, so in Maryland, he found true religious freedom, which he did not necessarily experience at Jamestown. Yeah, so. Well, it's been a great blessing being with you all. It's been almost 2 years since I've had the opportunity to interact with a lot of you. So it's been wonderful in that respect. And I hope this has been not only just informative, but appropriately inspiring and motivating as well, as we continue to fulfill our calling in Christ to be the true church. And the true church in the midst of a society that's becoming increasingly secularized, decadent, and dysfunctional. So we're here for a particular purpose. So let's resolve to fulfill that purpose to the greatest, to our greatest capacity. So blessings on you all. Good being with you.